All right, everybody. Well, welcome to the April call. My name is Mark Reynolds. I'll be hosting the call. If you are new to this call, those of us who are on this call every month use this as a call to keep ourselves organized around solving the enormous problem of global warming. We're not here to discuss it. We're not here to try and figure out how to win an argument. We're not here to fret about how bad it is. We're here to stay focused on how to solve the problem. So what we'll be doing is in a couple of minutes, I'm going to be introducing our guest speaker. Then we'll go over some of the results since last month's call. We'll talk about what we want to practice this month, because an important part of what we do every month isn't just that we're more informed on the issue, it's also that we're more articulate, and the only way to get more articulate is to continue to practice and practice and practice and practice and just find any excuse we can to practice speaking about the different elements related to this issue. And then the most important thing we do is to get into action. So we'll be going over what the recommended actions are for the U.S. and Canada, and hopefully as many people will take those as possible. Before I introduce our speaker, I always like to tell our speaker a little bit about who she's speaking with. Now, in this case, Renee Lertzman knows quite a bit about us. She did a great talk at our Northern California conference. She and I have been in communication over the last 2 years about our work and her work. But I nevertheless want to just tell her, you know, kind of what should she know about the people that she's speaking to. You know, George Bernard Shaw once said, people are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, they make them. And I think that speaks to a lot of people on the call, but I just want to point to one particular person today. So 2 years ago, Jim Probst started our first chapter in West Virginia. Now, since that time, he's formed chapters throughout the state of West Virginia and has headed up our team coal that's been working in coal extractive communities, which is a really crucial piece of us being effective with this, with getting done what we want to get done. Now, in the last 2 years, Jim and his team have had 24 meetings in the state of West Virginia. I want you to think of your own meetings. And if you went into a meeting where time after time you were going in and essentially the message you were getting back from offices is, why are you trying to ruin coal jobs? Not the easiest meetings in the world, and I don't think if that had happened to me 5 or 10 times, I don't know if 24 meetings later I would still be having meetings within coal country. But Jim and his team have continued to bring different reports to the congressional offices, just continuing to work from the perspective that we're partners with people no matter where they start on this issue, bringing the Rebby report showing net gains in jobs nationwide, whether it's in that community or not, showing the dividend impact study, showing that the impact our proposal has helps poor people a lot, and that helps in coal communities. But the thing I want you to know is that Jim will keep looking for something until he finds the right thing. Recently, he found a bill in Congress called the Reclaim Act, which actually has money designated to help coal communities make the transition. And it's really helped to expand and cement his partnership with people in West Virginia. Now, while that specific piece is useful for him, the thing, Renee, that I want you to know about the people you're talking to, he would have kept looking until he found something. Because these aren't the kind of people who are out there looking for an excuse why we're not going to succeed. They're out there looking for what they need to make sure that we do succeed. Okay, so everybody, let me just tell you a little bit about our speaker. So we've had a lot of scientists on this call. We've had a lot of economists. We've had faith leaders, military leaders, members of Congress, communication experts. In Renee's particular case, this is an issue area we have not had someone on the call. And she teaches the psychology of environmental education and communication in the MA program at Royal Roads University in British Columbia. Her work focuses on the intersection of psychology, environment, and culture to help organizations, governments, and businesses devise communication and engagement strategies for the uniquely challenging nature of environmental work. Her latest book is Environmental Melancholia, Psychoanalytic Dimensions of Engagement. So we've all taken what I consider the hard but important road of working on this issue. Instead of taking the mouse click version, we're taking the always working with people version, which is, I think, the only way we get across the finish line is to take the hard road. But it also means successfully working with people. And Renee's area of how you effectively engage people, I think, is really, really important, and we're really glad you could be on the call today. So if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about your work and how it applies to us, and welcome Renee Lertzman. Great to have you on the call today.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. Thank you.
Awesome. Great. Okay. So thank you for having me. It's it is a huge honor to be talking with you all for the precise reasons that Mark has laid out so well, which is the fact that, you know, this organization is singular and unique in its emphasis on the ground, sort of grassroots organizing in the way that you have designed it over the years. And the way I think about that is a term I use a lot in my work is frontliners or frontline workers. And what that means to me is in fact anyone who is having interactions with people, right? So it's sort of, you know, you could be on the shop floor and talking with people about energy efficient appliances. That's a front line. So in other words, any opportunities that we have for human interaction is really critical. And I think that, you know, thanks to Mark's leadership and the contributions of everyone in the organization, I think that's, you know, it's widely recognized and really critical. So building on the introduction that Mark has given, I want to, you know, obviously we don't have a whole lot of time. I have several minutes to share with you hopefully some insights and ideas, material that can get us thinking and sort of spark our creative sort of processes a bit more around this question of what it means to be more effective. So I want to start with just saying that, you know, I get that folks with CCL are, you know, very solutions oriented and very driven to find what works. And it's important to frame what I'm talking about here as simply resources and insights to amplify your work. So in other words, it's not to say what you're currently doing is not working, because we know that's not true. It's what I have found over decades of working with organizations, and I'll just add that I teach in a program, in a graduate program with communications professionals and educators in British Columbia in the summer. The rest of the time I'm working full-time as a consultant directly on providing sort of trainings and workshops on how folks in energy and climate sectors can be more effective. And in doing so, I've learned a whole lot about what really works and what really matters in this context. So it's been quite a journey, as you can imagine, from having been more or less an academic researcher to deciding about 3 or 4 years ago, you know, it really, what matters most to me is having direct impact. Not to say researchers don't have direct impact, but there's nothing like being part of designing a campaign, watching it come together, and then being able to see the direct impact all maybe within a matter of weeks. It's just completely exhilarating, as I think everyone can appreciate. So what I want to talk about in the time I have here is the vital role that psychological insights have for our work in climate change. And I say this including every aspect of work in climate change. It could be whether you're an engineer, technician, a campaigner, a communications professional, that understanding the psychological dimensions of what goes on for people around climate change is really not a luxury. It's not an add-on. It's not a nice to have. It's actually completely integral and essential to reach our targets and to be as effective as we can be. Now, I know that there's a fair amount that we already know about, you know, people have been talking about the psychology of climate change for a while. You know, we've got the Six Americas, and we've got, you know, ideas, research papers around trying to get a handle on how we can be more effective around persuasion. And what I want to say is the psychology that I'm talking about is really different. It's not competing with that, but it's coming at this from a very different angle, and it's a new and more emerging area of work that I'm really excited to be part of. Before I get into what the psychological insights are, however, I need to first talk with you, and obviously I can't see you. I wish we were all in the room together. But I want to look at this concept of engagement, because engagement is something that we all talk about a lot. We all aspire to do. Some of us feel we do it really well. Some of us feel we could do it better. And I, you know, what I find in my work with folks is, when we start with first looking at engagement and what we mean by engagement, you know, to really kind of take a pause And if we were in a room together, I would be writing engagement, you know, on a flip chart, and I would say, what does this really mean? What do we mean by this? And so on this call, we can think about it like a lotto card, right, where you're sort of taking a coin and you're scratching it. And we're looking at what's underneath the surface of what we mean by engaging people. And what I find, you know, in absence of being able to hear from you all directly, you can think about this for a minute. You know, what do you mean when you want to engage people? And what it often means for us is that we want to get people to care, we want to get people motivated, and we want to make people act, which all make complete sense. Now, the reason why it's really important to be, you know, mindful of what this is that there's something that sort of underlies those orientations, which is that we're trying to get people to do something. And that's a very certain kind of attitude and mentality to have. It positions us towards our audiences or people we're working with in a very particular way. And it's a way that has been not very effective, to be honest. It can be kind of conveyed unconsciously as a sort of a sense that we're trying to make people kind of come over to our side. There's understandably frustration. You know, I think we've all had interactions that have been frustrating and puzzling and maybe even despairing when we're not successful at, quote-unquote, getting people to see things the way we all need to be seeing them. So, you know, I want to look at a definition of engagement that I've been using now for a while that came out of some British researchers. There's a whole group of British researchers focusing on climate change engagement, very thoughtful work. And this came out of a paper published by Lauren Zoni and Whitmarsh, and I'm happy to share that reference for anyone who's interested later. But basically what they said is that engagement is really when we are engaged at the cognitive, behavioral, and affective levels. Okay, so cognitive, behavioral, and affective. And that engagement really can't happen without all of those three sort of coming together in a very kind of interrelated way. And so what this means for us is the part about the affective. That's the part that we understand the least about right now. That's the most leading edge in terms of where we need and are starting to look more closely at, which is the emotional dimension. You know, we could call it emotion, we can call it affective, but really what this calls on us to understand is what is going on for people emotionally and affectively when we bring up and engage with these topics of climate change. Now, you know, I think that a lot of us feel that we already maybe are using emotion and affect very effectively because a lot of research tells us, well, you know, people need to feel that this touches them directly. We need to feel that this is short-term versus long-term, that human brains are not wired to come to terms with long-term. And I don't buy that at all, to be honest. I think that I come from a more of a social psychology background. I think a lot of this is culturally and socially kind of created in that our culture is very short-term oriented. Human brains are designed to respond in the fight, flight, or freeze to threats. We know that that's very clear, but we also know that humans have enormous neuroplasticity and capacity to shift our orientations to longer-term, more systemic, and more complex information processing. We know that. However, what we also know from neuroscience is that affect is critical. So, in other words, we can't really look at the way that humans process information without really looking at the affect or the emotion that, as a colleague of mine says, greases the wheel. Now, when we talk about short-term immediate impacts, if you don't do this, this is going to happen in your community, in your neighborhood. That can be a powerful lever. However, what it also can do is arouse such profound anxiety for people that we're not even conscious of, that we end up in a place that we don't want to be, which is in people's defenses. And people's defenses against anxiety and distressing information is a human function. There's nothing pathological about it. I know I only have a couple of minutes left, but I'm going to conclude with this point, which is It's not pathological that humans protect ourselves from distress and situations that we feel, frankly, are sort of unthinkable. And for a lot of people, climate threats are unthinkable, right? It's just like kind of almost outside of our domain of reality. Sort of like the planes coming into the Twin Towers. It's sort of like it's beyond the thinkable until it happens, right? And so what that means for us is that when we are talking with people and engaging with people about these issues, what can happen is anxieties are mobilized or generated, right? And then we are stuck with defensive kind of, I don't want to hear about it, you know, minimizing, discounting, maybe even attacking, all of that can happen. And so that's a very real, very critical piece of this puzzle, which is why becoming skilled in working with these dynamics is not a luxury or a bolt-on. It's actually just as important as understanding the science, the policy, the technology, every aspect that we think is critical to climate work. Understanding the affective or the emotional is equally as important. And so where does this lead us? So what do we do with this? Well, one of the main ways that people's defenses can be softened is when we feel safe. And so this comes out of psychotherapy. You know, we're not talking about sitting in a consulting room, right, with a counselor. We're going to have to innovate ways to create safety, and that includes being able to really listen. It includes the ability to create a safe environment where people feel that it's okay for them to have whatever it is they're feeling. And it includes skills, like very tangible skills that we can learn and develop that help us be more effective in our interactions that are based on motivational interviewing and sort of open questions and, you know, how we design our interactions and, frankly, our campaign strategy as well. So it's not just about one-to-one interactions. It's not just about in-person. Applying this kind of compassionate approach to working with people's, you know, kind of emotional responses to this can be and is being done, you know, whether it's in a messaging campaign or whatever. And that's a big part of what I do as a professional, as I partner with organizations around that work. And one of the exciting things about it is that it's really innovative. It's really new. And we're trying to figure out, you know, what makes most sense. But the good news is that we have such an abundance of research and insight already that we don't have to go out and totally reinvent the wheel. But I will say this, and I'll end on this note, is that I believe that climate change psychology is unique. And I believe that we really do need to understand this in a distinct way. So, you know, we tend to look at other kind of examples of when public will, you know, or engagement shifts, gay marriage and, you know, whatever that social issue is. And I would say that climate and environmental issues is really sort of in its own category. And so, you know, my sense is that we're all actually, one way to think about it is we're all innovators. You know, and that may resonate for some of you more than others, but it's sort of the truth, is that we're all innovating, and hopefully that kind of frees up our own sense of experimentation and piloting and trying things out and recognizing that this is really a collective effort. So I think I'll end because I believe I'm at my time, Mark. And
let me follow up with a couple of things then. First of all, so you mentioned being puzzled and how people respond to communication. I might need a personal cultural session because most of my puzzlement is with my personal family and friends. But one of the things that I found that you said that was incredibly refreshing that I'd like to hear a little bit more about is you said you can make a case for that we're capable of, all of us are capable of long-term thinking. And most people make the other argument, that we're only good at the short-term thinking and only working from a short-term, short time frame. Can you just say a little bit more about why you say, no, I actually think we're capable of working from long-term or the big picture?
Sure. So let me ask you a question. Do you feel that you're capable of thinking long-term?
Yes, but I'm quite unique.
Are you?
No, I don't
okay.
know.
Okay. Is everyone on this? Yeah, I mean,
actually, all the people on this call are unique. They're capable of long term. We're just not sure about everybody else.
Okay, so that's the sort of a fallacy I'm trying to explore here, which is we tend to sort of forget that a lot of people we work with and know have extraordinary capacity to think long term. The question is why? The question is what cultivated that? You know, I have friends who are geological scientists. Of course, their sense of time is going to be very different from someone else. But there's so much support for how different cultures and societies engage with the future differently. And that's why I say that it's kind of like a yes and. So I'm not refuting the neuroscientific work around the human, that our limbic system is designed to be at a very primitive level, fight, flight, or freeze. So I'm not arguing against that, of course. I'm not taking on that. I'm saying yes and. I'm saying that we've got to be careful that we don't become reductive and that we don't create unnecessary limitations in our thinking. So in other words, it's more like let's factor that in as a very critical piece of the picture. And let's also look at what's happening right now and on many fronts where people are actually looking at how do we cultivate longer term, more systems kinds of thinking. And that's an active field that's, you know, really exciting right now. And it has to do with, you know, new ways of processing information. But the affective is, it can't be separate. It can't be separate because fear and anxiety shut that down. Fear and anxiety, like we know neurologically, it literally shuts down our frontal lobe. And so we're unable to engage in that kind of foresight that is needed right now.
Okay. I think this is a really, really important piece for us because we're always trying to make the case for what is it about people that allows for us to solve big problems with them. So, for instance, you know, how I started the call. Our coal country team is committed to working with people in coal country, not being adversarial. But I think what you're saying here is kind of a new piece we can take on. I think it's easy to make the excuse that people only think short term, and then it kind of gets you off the hook. I always prefer the arguments or the views that keep you on the hook for, you know, okay, yes, we can succeed with the particular people we're dealing with. So I love taking on the perspective of course, the people we're working with can look from a long term, and that's how we're going to work with them.
Exactly, and I have to say that's the essence of my work as a strategist, is that I learned from Eric Fromm years ago, who wrote a beautiful book called The Art of Loving. He writes about when we relate to people as if they are already, you know, engaged and loving and smart, humans tend to rise and meet you there. So that's kind of a 101, like as a teacher, you want to relate with your students, you know, as if they have unlimited potential, because then that creates, it's the exact same thing. When we go into our interactions with an unconscious assumption that people are short-term, greedy, stupid, ignorant, you know, whatever it is that we might be secretly thinking, that will come through in our interactions, and it will actually shape the interaction. It doesn't matter what you say. You know, even if you have, it's just the energy you bring to the interaction, it will shape that. People will sense it, and they'll be defensive.
I think that's just such an important piece for all of us because, you know, being familiar with our work, it always is about finding what we have in common with people, but there might be some suspicions we have in the back of our mind, but, you know, not really maybe up to big things. And what we're making a case for here is, yes, they are. And we're going to find that out about them, and we're going to work with them on that. And it's not going to be something that we secretly harbor that they're not that way. We're going to build on that these are long-term thinkers.
Right. But I will say there's some inner work that needs to happen to get there. It's not going to just magically happen if we are really frustrated and upset and despairing. We're not going to magically become, you know, deeply curious and empathetic towards our audiences. There's a piece there which involves our inner, kind of some inner work around working through our feelings and attitudes about the people we're relating with and not getting down on ourselves for having those feelings, right? It's not about shaming and say, oh, I'm such a bad person. It's like, you know, this makes sense I'd be feeling this way. These are really painful, hard issues. And I'm going to do what I need to do to go into this interaction, you know, kind of trusting that as a human being, we kind of all want some of the same things.
Yep. Okay. This is really, 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 there's just a huge amount of juice for us here. Let me dig down into the weeds real quick on one particular thing with you, if you don't mind. And that is, my understanding is you were involved in some of the ClearPath research about messaging that worked with conservatives. And can you tell us a little bit about what we learned from doing that? Because that was, you know, engaged, interactive kind of research, wasn't it?
It was. So I designed the research method, which, you know, I want to make a plug for doing research that is qualitative and really based on having conversations. So it's not a surprise, right, that we're talking about conversations, and so the research methods need to be conversational. So we did in-depth interviews with 30 Republicans around the U.S., plus focus groups, and they were designed very carefully to cultivate conversation. That's a really important point, so that no one was asked point blank about what do you think about climate or carbon tax, or never direct questions. And so what we found in that process is a rich, just incredible richness of what people were able to share that included their concerns and their anxieties and their desires. And so what we did is we then, you know, so this is what I was doing in partnership with my client who is running the research project, is how to integrate those insights into the message. And so that's what we did. And so, the main, you know, the person I was working with, Rich Tao, basically was able to take those concerns and anxieties and create a message which then had, you know, scored exceptionally highly with the audiences. So it went through kind of a live dial testing process. And what that demonstrated, and that there's a 2-minute clip that I show and Rich shows at meetings, what it demonstrates is just irrefutable, is that when we are able to really acknowledge people's anxieties and concerns, we're more able to move them into the aspirational. So the arc is, you know, we know that, you know, you might feel X, Y, and Z, and that's why we're focusing on this. And you can't really get to the solution, the focus, until you acknowledge people's anxieties and their ambivalence. And that, again, is sort of a critical, you know, strategic point here, is that we can't go to the solution. We can't go to where we want people to be until you listen effectively enough to really hear the concern. And I guess I'll say about the Republican project, you know, it's the most interesting project I've been involved with to date. And that's largely because what I really heard in the interviews was so much conflict. It was really poignant. You know, I heard people say, you know, if I knew that climate change was real, I would become a climate activist. This is like a hardcore conservative working class guy who runs a construction business in Michigan. You know, it's just very, very moving, where it's like people are kind of stuck. Like they want to move there, but they can't quite go there. You know, we're so bound up in like our identity stuff, and what does it mean if I take this seriously, and what are the implications for my life and my everything I've worked to develop. It's very moving stuff, and it has definitely affected my perceptions of how, you know, everyone is relating with this, and it's made it a lot more complicated and more nuanced.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you so much for making yourself available. If you're open to it, we'd love to have you back for a second dose sometime.
Oh, I'd love that. Thank you.
All right. Great, Renee. Thank you so much. Just great.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
And you're welcome to stick
okay.
around for the next 15 minutes if you want.
Okay. Thanks.
Great. So a couple things, everybody. First of all, loved that. I wanted to give you an update from our development director, Lene Pettengill. She's wanted to be on the call, but she's on a plane right now to meet with some donors. On April 1st, we launched the monthly donor challenge. Before the challenge launched, we had 185 monthly donors who provide consistent support for our work throughout the year. If we double that number, if we add 185 new monthly donors during the month of April, then we get a $35,000 matching grant. So we're off to a great start. Since April 1st, we've added 104 new monthly donors. So if we recruit 81 more, we get the $35,000 matching grant. So if you want to be part of this, you can go to citizensclimatelobby.org/monthly. That would be, you could become a monthly donor. And again, we're on, for everybody who joined that program, thank you so much. We're really, really grateful. And monthly donors help us so much in getting a little bit more predictable in terms of revenue coming in. So thank you all for that. Also, I want you to know that 3 more people have qualified as the having done 8 presentations by the conference. So at the conference, they're going to get both the clicker pointer thing and also the shirt. So that's Dick Smith and Dan Dietrich from from Wisconsin and David Klein from Colorado. So congratulations to all of you. And anybody who's done 8 or more presentations, make sure and let us know so that we can make sure you get the reward at the conference. Also, we had a lot of progress in the endorser program this month. And sometimes people confuse the endorser program and they think that there's a group and they do all the endorsements. Really, the endorser program, the endorser team is just there to make sure that there is a support structure for everybody else. So, for instance, there's no way that Representative Carlos Cobello would have started the Bipartisan Climate Solution Caucus without a ton of support in the community, you know, other leaders, mayor, city council members. So the endorser program is really important in that way, and we had 41 actions on the endorser program this month, so a lot of activity. A couple I'll just point to real quickly. In Utah, the League of Women Voters endorsed our proposal, and that's big because League of Women Voters, this is their second highest priority for this year, so I think that that could give other groups a signal that they could reach to League of Women Voters in their community. And also in San Luis Obispo, the San Luis Obispo City Council endorsed our proposal. Congratulations to our team up there. That is also great work. I also want to mention, as part of the outreach activity for April for all the Earth Day stuff, we created the conservative outreach flyer. I hope you've seen it. If not, get it from CCL Community because it's really, really good. It's appealing, saying, are you conservative and you concerned about climate change? Some of our volunteers were at a John Kasich event, and they wanted to ask questions, but there wasn't any way for them to get in the line to ask questions, so they started handing out flyers as people came out, and they just were swamped with people wanting to hear a message that said, are you conservative and you care about climate change? So that was great. Amy, can you come on for a second? Our Director of Operations, Amy Bennett.
Yes, Mark.
Great. Okay, so a couple things with you and I, Amy. First of all, I want to talk about the conference for one moment. So, you know, we want to see all 535 offices on Capitol Hill this June, and that's as everybody knows who's ever been involved in it, that's a huge undertaking, and there's a lot of things that need to happen. But the very first thing that needs to happen is we need to find out who's going to schedule the appointments for every single office. So if you're a CCL liaison, this week you got an email from Amy, and what that email asked is, are you the appointment setter for the June conference? Now, we don't want you to respond to Amy in the email by emailing her back. We want you to go to the link in that email and click saying yes or no, either yes, I'm scheduled the appointment, or maybe I've already scheduled the appointment, which some people have, or no, I'm not, so we can figure out who the appointment scheduler is. And we're going to be targeting all the appointment dates on Tuesday, June 21st. But it's really, really important that the first step in trying to get 535 appointments to happen is we need to find out who's scheduling the appointments. So if you're an existing CCL liaison, you should have gotten an email from Amy, and we don't want you to respond yes or no to the email. We want you to go click on a link, and then if you say yes, then it'll give you another link that you'll just keep updating between now and the conference so we know what's happening. Amy, did I get anything wrong or anything need to be corrected on that?
No, Mark, there is another option in that link is if you know who the appointment setter is, if it's not you, you can put that information in as well. So
okay,
that's perfect.
Okay, thank you. So then, Amy, you monitor all the results that come in every month. What are the things that jump out at you this month?
This month, there are several things that jumped out at me, Mark. Number one, the number of letters to the editors we had was 232, which is terrific. Op-eds, we had 41. And the other thing we're working on right now is getting the data in from the spring lobby drive meetings. And the number of what we refer to as face-to-face meetings that we have with congressional offices, we refer to face-to-face. That means with the actual Congress member versus staff. We have great meetings with staff, but a face-to-face refers to a meeting with the member. And that number has been 9%. Now, for the spring lobby drive, it is 35% of those meetings have been face-to-face, so that really jumps out at me.
Okay, so over time, our average is 9%, and that's oftentimes because in Washington, D.C., they'll confirm a face-to-face, and then the member gets pulled away to a committee hearing or something like that. But the spring lobby drive is running at 35% right now.
That's right.
Okay, good. So, well, and the thing that I'm excited about hearing that is, you know, we haven't had a chance to review all the notes from Spring Lobby Drive, but some of the anecdotal information we're hearing is very exciting in terms of how people are receiving the information about their district. In one case, we even had our group walked in, and the district didn't do well. But what the office said is this is the information we've been asking from you from the minute we started doing this. So it was like we provided a service of something they'd always wanted, and now we could say this is exactly how it will work out with people in your district. Okay, then, Amy, the last thing I want to ask you about is, you know, we have all these things we didn't track. We track letters to the editor. We track meetings with congressional offices, parliamentary offices, editorial board meetings. We have one category that's been in zero for forever, and finally we were able to mark a one this month, and that category is one of our board members went to a state dinner with Mr. Obama and Mr. Trudeau where they discussed climate change, and in traditional CCL fashion, our board member went up to Mr. Obama and thanked him for showing leadership on climate change. So that's the first time we were ever able to mark off the category CCL board member thanks president for showing leadership on climate change. How many years has it been that we've been at zero in that category?
It's been 7 years, Mark.
All right, sweet. So it's nice to finally get one after 7 years. Amy, thank you so much for that quick update.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So one other thing that I want to mention about the conference is I know everybody knows that Michael Mann's going to be speaking, but I'd like to just give you a quick update on some of the other people who are on panels or on breakout sessions. So this includes Bob Inglis, Jerry Taylor from Niskanen, Kia Chatterty from U.S. Can, Bill Twist from Pachamama on the Climate Disruption Around the World Highly Vulnerable Places panel includes people from UNICEF, Audubon, and Amazon Watch. And then Environmental Justice panel includes NAACP, NRDC, and also UNICEF again. The Weather and Climate panel includes Dr. Tony Broccoli from Rutgers, Dr. Dan David Doth from the University of Maryland. The International panel includes Alden Miner from the UN's Union of Concerned Scientists. The public health panel includes Dr. Jonathan Tatz, Dr. Mona Sephardi, and Dr. Natasha Desjardins. Hope I got that right. The climate security panel includes General John Castella and Roger Sorkin, who is the executive producer of the film The Burden. And then last, for those of you who are bringing your teenage or college-aged or maybe even younger kids, I've heard people who are bringing their particular teens, in some cases college-age students, there is a young person's panel. Do we really mean to address everything from, you know, very young people to high schoolers to college to how to make this issue meaningful and how to do outreach in those communities? So those are just some of them. It's not all of them. You can get more of those from the website by clicking on the breakout sessions, but we're excited about a lot of the people that we have as panelists and also on the breakout sessions. Okay, now what are the things that we're hoping you'll practice this month? So we have a choice, and we have a choice of either one of two laser talks or an interactive role play. And the role play is like last month's where we're really working as an organization, and I think this fits in with what Renee was saying, is trying to be better at interviewing people, drawing people out, asking people's questions. So the role play is around China. And it's designed to get to places that we hope to get by being interested and curious with the person we're speaking with rather than just giving them key points. On the other hand, we also have two laser talks. If you remember last month, we said that what we learned from the June debrief is that there are six key issues that come up on a regular basis and that two of those laser talks would be last month, two would be this month, and two would be next month. So that we would have the things that come up the most often we would feel we're the most prepared on. You know, it's interesting. There's a professional basketball player named Steph Curry. He's the best basketball player in the world. And, you know, before him you could clearly have said that Michael Jordan was the best basketball player in the world. And what is unique about them in both cases is they simply practice more than anybody else. You know, some people provide leadership in different ways, and Steph Curry's teammates talk about him providing leadership not because he's vocal, not because he speaks up. He just works harder than everybody else, and his work ethic provides a kind of leadership for the team that's propelled them to perhaps set a new record of the most wins in the history of the NBA this year. We'll see over the next three games. But anyway, we want to practice every month, and the only way we're going to become more articulate is if we do practice. So whether you practice the laser talks in the meeting, whether you do the role play, whether you do all of them, the most important thing is that every single month we are practicing because we can only become more effective by practicing. We can only become better listeners if we know what we're going to say so we don't have to think about it and we can actually have our attention on the other people. Okay, so in Canada, we're going to be asking everybody to focus on media and getting the Earth Day editorial packet out, and also inviting your MP to the climate change reception on Parliament Hill. In the U.S., we have something where every single person can be in action, and we would like every single person to be in action. We're going to do an Earth Day call-in on April 21st, and you can attach to our Facebook with this, so if you want to get all your Facebook friends on it. We want to not only call every member of Congress a lot of times on April 21st, but there's a link in the action sheet so that you can note that you've done so, and we would like to keep a record of how many calls actually came in on the 21st. If you forget to do it on the 21st and you do it on the 20th or the 22nd, it's not the end of the world, but we know concentrated action gets people's attention. And then the last is April is always our biggest opportunity in both the U.S. and Canada to get published. So we want to make sure that every group got someone who's submitting an op-ed and that everybody's sending letters to the editor in, because in April, this is when the papers are most open to publishing our material. So let's make sure that as many of us can get published as possible during the month of April. Again, designate somebody to do the op-ed. Let's all make sure we're sending in tons of letters to the editor and just, again, use April as an opportunity to get a huge amount of media out there for us. All right, everybody. Well, thank you all for everything you did this last month. I'm sure we'll have a spectacular month again this month. I'm going to unmute the line, so if you want to say goodbye to the rest of the people around the world who are either on the call live or listening to the recording over the next month, you can do so. Bear with me just one sec.